George Johnson, are you there?
Hey, John, good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Summer has finally arrived here. It's been apparently the rainiest and one of the coldest Junes so far in the history of weatherkeeping in New York. And I guess this is true of much of the Northeast. And I recently heard Susie's dad lives in Steamboat Springs, Susie, my wife, and he's visiting now, and he said that Colorado also is has been extremely rainy and
cold. Same here in Santa Fe. Yeah, it's yeah, May and June both. Usually these are bone dry months here. Mm-hmm. So like if you have any kind of landscape you're trying to maintain, even if you're using, you know, very xeric plants and things, which we do, you really have to struggle in a way to get through May and June, because it's just bone dry, and you're past the late spring snows, and then you have to wait until usually 4th of July or a little after for our annual so-called monsoon season to hit. But instead, we've had, you know, nice little steady rains throughout the last couple of months, so it's been really nice.
Oh, so everything it's much greener than normal out there.
Yeah, greener and cooler, and, you know, at the worst this time of year, it might get into the 90s, but I don't think it's broken 90 yet. It's just been very, very pleasant, and, yeah, things are greening up, and I have drip irrigation, so I you know, usually in a normal year by this time, I'd be doing it maybe once a week and sometimes twice a week, and I think I've done it once all season.
So
probably
is this
unnecessary? So it's pretty great. And when it rains too, we collect the rain and rain barrels, and then I use that and, you know, pump it on the trees to give them a little extra water.
So, do you think we could say that this is another nail in the coffin of the global warming hoax?
Well, you know, the name now is global climate change.
Ah.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to somebody last night at there was a Santa Fe Institute party, and someone noted that the discourse had subtly shifted over the years to where people were saying global climate change. So then if you're getting global cooling, like we seem to be getting here with this very tiny meaningless data set, you know, it still fits in. The climate's changing, John.
Oh, that's the politically... Well, who ever doubted that climate changes?
Interesting. I guess it's a matter of timing, you know. But
this is why I'm trying not to read the paper recently, which because I realized that so many of these stories go in cycles. If I stop reading now, I'll miss the whole cycle of this rhetorical change in the global climate debate, and and by the time I start reading papers again, which I inevitably will, it will be back to where it was when I left off.
Well, it's true. The news is very cyclical. It's kind of amazing, you know, especially if you work in the news industry, as I have since 1975 or 76. You see the same stories again and again, except there's two striking exceptions. One being science news. I mean, global warming is, you know, it's going to be a long story that, you know, takes a long time to cycle, I think. But, you know, there actually are new things that are discovered. So that's...
Like what? Name one!
Sometimes that's what I tell people. That's why I like to write about science, because in a way it's the only area of the news where anything new really ever happens.
Yeah.
But I'm going to take that back, because I was thinking this morning when I looked at the paper and, you know, Michael Jackson died.
Yeah, I heard that from my kids last night.
That only happens once. So obituaries and science news.
Good riddance to that bastard.
Oh, John.
Well, sorry, but I happen to...
Yeah, the whole sleazy...
The reason I say that is because I actually knew... I know the family who was involved in that first molestation case, and I know what he did. And and he's I really think he was, you know, I don't normally call people evil, but I think he was an evil person. In other words, a manipulative son of a bitch who used his power and money to get what he wanted from people, including, you know, just kids, regardless of the consequences. So, you know, good riddance.
Yeah, I just know what I read in the paper, and boy, he's certainly getting, it's like he's practically getting a state funeral, it looks like.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
Not well, he really, was talented. Literally, but God, I mean, it's like the lead story in the Times, which, I don't know. So.
Well, it just shows, again, the complete disconnection between artistic talent and any kind of moral qualities.
Well, yeah, and the short-lived memory of all of us, of the public, and you know, of which I certainly include myself. I'm thinking about the commentaries during Ronald Reagan's funeral a few years ago, and you know, you had all this solemn, you know, the newscasters and all talking about the great communicator, and you know, someone who was, you know, a lot of us would argue until a new standard was set. With our previous administration was one of the worst, was the worst presidency in our lifetimes. But
Surely there was Christopher Hitchens or somebody like that must have...
To remind, probably so. But, you know, the mainstream TV network newscasters, which, you know, were still considered mainstream back then.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
We're already rambling, John.
That's what keeps the audience coming back, George.
Yeah, that's what keeps me coming back, anyway. But what's going on?
What were we going to talk about
science,
today?
Yeah.
George.
You'd mentioned a really cool story by my neighbor Sam Bowles, who's at the Santa Fe Institute.
Right.
A new paper that he's come out with. And there was an interesting article in New Scientist kind of summarizing it about... warfare and altruism. So could you describe that? Because it's really...
Yeah. Somebody who knows about my obsession with the evolution of warfare sent this to me as soon as it appeared in Science. I haven't seen... I'm too cheap to pay the couple of bucks to get the original paper in Science, so I'm just relying on...
Oh, it's actually on Sam's website.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah.
I'll check that out. Well, so just going on the basis of the New Scientist... summary of it, Bowles had, he's done two things. First of all, he's done an empirical study of rates of violence among different hunter-gatherer groups around the world. And so I think this encompasses both ethnographic studies of hunter-gatherers who've survived into the modern era and an analysis of skeletons of hunter-gatherer groups that go back thousands of years, and he's come up with a rough estimate of the level of death from violence among these groups, and it's about 16% of the people in these groups die violently, and in this piece anyway, it doesn't distinguish between homicide, interpersonal violence, and group violence, but sometimes it's hard to distinguish these among these very small groups. Anyway.
Well, yeah, I bet. I mean, especially if you're just looking at skeletons.
But that's 16% is a fairly high figure. It's roughly comparable to the rates among the Yanomamo, which is the Amazonian tribe that Napoleon Chagnon has described at great length. I think there the rate of violent death was something like 25%. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 16% is pretty close to that. Just to give you a point of comparison, the estimates for the number of people who died of war-related causes in the 20th century range up as high as 200 million people. And that sounds like a lot, but that's only about 2% of all the deaths in the 20th century.
Now, is that specifically war?
Specifically war, but that also counts famine and disease that are related to war.
And
genocide, for example, Stalin's purge of his own people, deaths in revolutionary China. The Jewish Holocaust under Nazi Germany and those sorts of things. So, you know, it's really interesting that This completely turns the old idea of Rousseau of primitive people being relatively peaceful and then corrupted and turned right. violent by civilization. Turns it completely on its head.
And
actually, levels of violence were quite high among these societies. So both starts there.
Believe it or not, we're improving.
Yeah, according to some measures.
Okay.
So that's an empirical study that he's done. Then he's done these computer models of altruistic tendencies in a given population that would be similar to these hunter-gatherers. And he's assuming that, so hunter-gatherer societies were pretty much egalitarian, non-hierarchical, so nobody can force a person to fight in these societies. They have to do so of their own free will, and yet they would fight because, Bowles is conjecturing, because of allegiance to the group, which is basically altruism. And he's assuming that this kind of altruistic behavior that's in the, in the service of violence of one group against another group might actually benefit the group as a whole. So it's a group selection model.
So it's altruistic in the sense that the individual is taking the risk that they're going to get killed in a war, and the war doesn't necessarily benefit them individually, but it benefits the group.
Yeah, so it's sort of like...
That must be hard to disentangle, what benefits the group and what benefits you as a member of the group, right?
Yeah, it's sort of similar to... So one of the familiar examples of altruistic behavior looks at... prairie dogs who are, they're poking their heads out of their holes in the desert, and then one of them sees a hawk flying around, and he screams to alert the others. Now his
or a bulldozer.
Yeah, right. And then a hawk would be better because a bulldozer is going to wipe them all out. But by screaming,
not in Santa Fe, but I can get into that. We actually have all these laws where they have to be. If you're building someplace where there are prairie dogs, you have to capture them and then, bring them to a better place and, offer them GI benefits and things and an education and health insurance. But anyway.
Oh, you sound so cynical, George. Well, so the point is that the prairie dog is endangering its own survival by screaming and yelling and alerting the rest of the group.
Yeah.
And that sort of behavior is similar to what Bowles is.
Okay,
he's
that's
about.
The classic example, and that he's applying it. So he's saying that, somewhat paradoxically, that war gives rise to altruism and may have strengthened these altruistic bonds.
Yeah, and
counterintuitively, I should say.
Yeah, one of the immediate problems is that in some of these really small hunter-gatherer groups, there's a lot of genetic interrelatedness, as you might imagine. And so some of the critics could try to explain this sort of behavior in terms of kin selection.
Yeah, they're so inbred that they're going to have genes in common with the all the members of the group.
That's right,
and it'd be very hard to find people who weren't related on some significant level.
Yeah. So Bowles he tries to distinguish this group selection from kin selection. Kin selection is still sort of within the selfish gene paradigm, but I'm not so sure how successfully he does it. There's something about these group selection discussions that always strike me as having to do more with how you define terms than with the reality out there.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I think we've talked about this before, that it wasn't so long ago that you couldn't even say the words group selection and, maintain your status as a scientist. It was just considered anathema, right?
That's right. But there have been, Steve Gould, before he died, was espousing group selection. The great evolutionary biologist Edward Wilson at Harvard has come out very strongly for group selection in the past few years. So there does seem to be some kind of shift going on there.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a guy named a different Wilson. I think Edward Sloan Wilson, is it? Anyway,
Edward Sloan Kaufman,
who has written a couple of books arguing that that religion might have prospered as a result of group selection. So
yeah, so again, the idea being that religion binds these people together and makes them more cooperative, and this benefits the group.
Yeah.
And it benefits the individual as a member of the group. And
right.
Which so,
seems,
yeah.
It seems very sensible to me.
You have to fit in with your... I mean, you have more well-formed ideas on origins of warfare and its inevitability than I do. So how does Bowles fit in with that?
Well, you know, there's so many different ways that you can interpret something like this. First of all, Ed Wilson... the Harvard guy has a passage in his old book, it's still a wonderful book, I go back to it all the time, On Human Nature, which I think was originally published, I've got a copy here somewhere, in 1978.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of an attempt to apply Darwinian thinking to human behavior. And he says, he's got this passage in there where he's talking about altruism. Mm-hmm. And the altruistic behavior, specifically of ants and termites, who some members of these populations very sort of automatically sacrifice themselves when they get when one colony gets in a fight with a another colony, and you can explain this very easily in terms of kin selection. And
yeah.
Wilson said that if humans had this kind of altruism, we would have all been killed by now, because you would have constant examples of murder suicide, of people basically committing the equivalent of suicide bombings in defense of their own group. So he's saying it's actually a good thing that altruism, in the same way as aggression, is very much modulated by reason and by our circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there are very few compulsive altruists, there are very few compulsive aggressors. So that's one point. You know, another thing I've got to say, and I wish I brought this up when I more clearly, when I talked to Richard Wrangham, the Demonic Males author,
mm-hmm.
I think this was last month. There is so Bowles is going back and looking at the evidence of violence among hunter-gatherers, and basically our ancestors are thought to have lived as hunter-gatherers for about two million years that the Homo genus has existed. So the first was Homo habilis, who emerged about 2 million years ago, followed very quickly by Homo erectus, people like Bowles are sort of inferring that there was a lot of violence among these groups based on observations of modern-day hunter-gatherers. But there is absolutely no archaeological or fossil evidence of violence going back further than about 12,000 years,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is not usually... I mean, Bowles doesn't bring it up, at least not in this, not in what I've seen about his science article. Richard Wrangham doesn't mention this. People who talk about how far back violence goes in human history, they're making inferences based on modern-day hunter-gatherers, but other than that, very circumstantial evidence, there's really no hard evidence at all that violence goes back before, much before civilization and agriculture.
Yeah, but it's so hard to find evidence of anything when you go back that far.
Yeah, but we can find evidence, for example, of the beginnings of culture, of burials, or cave paintings that go back tens of thousands of years, of people starting to create elaborate clothing for themselves. So,
But you're saying that they're not finding a significant number of skeletons or fossilized skeletons that show signs of violence?
That's right. I just think that's something that needs pointing out. And modern-day hunter-gatherers are, I mean, any anthropologist will acknowledge that you have to be very careful in drawing analogies between groups like the Kung or Australian Aborigines or the Yanomamo, for that example. And they're not really classic hunter-gatherers because they do engage in some agriculture. But the analogies between these modern groups and whatever our ancestors were doing 100,000 or a million years ago are really inferential.
Yeah.
So.
This all reminds me of. Did you see the piece that Wilford had in the Times this week?
No.
It was another one of these things where they discovered a surprisingly old musical instrument dated to, I think, 35,000 years ago.
Uh huh.
And that, for one thing, that illustrates your point that you can go way back and find evidence of things like music.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, I'm just finding the story now. John Noble Wilford in the Times, about 35,000 years ago, flute in a cave in southwestern Germany, and it brings up those same kinds of questions as about altruism. And in Bowles' paper, just this idea of a binding force having this group selection advantage. In this case, the binding force maybe being music.
Right.
And that just got me thinking about what people think they know at this point about the evolution of music. And then I was just doing a quick search, and I found a really neat overview that ran in, I think it might have been New Scientist, but it might not. No, it was in The Economist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll link to that. People, it's called Why Music, from back in December. But I guess that's one of the theories that music was almost like a grooming kind of behavior in some ways. Or I guess the different theories are: one is that it's completely accidental. It's Gould had called a spandrel, just a byproduct of other things that evolved. Mm-hmm. And then another, not unrelated idea, that it's a form of sexual signaling, like, peacock plumes, the male singing to lure the female. And then this other idea that it's part of a group selection altruism kind of thing, that it's a way to bind people together to work for the common good. And, of course, it could have been a spandrel, an accident of evolution, and then been incorporated and prospered for those two other reasons. But same kind of issues, right?
Yeah, definitely. That's all these. First of all, a lot of these explanations are, they're sometimes presented as mutually exclusive, but they don't have to be.
Yeah.
And and there's something that's sort of bothersome about all of them. They do seem to be, that's why Steve Gould, I think, rightfully complained that. That too much of this stuff was, it was really not very rigorous, it was untestable, you're just sort of coming up with these retrospective explanations.
Yeah, the just-so stories.
The just-so stories. So that's why I think it is important just to remind people of the empirical facts, for example, the complete lack of hard evidence of group violence going back really before sedentary agricultural societies started forming.
Yeah, but they were sitting around playing flutes.
Yeah.
Right. At least a few of them.
Yes, and then, of course, it wasn't long before we had the emergence of martial music serving the cause of warfare.
Well, marching off to war, and then you're rallying the people for the Sam Bowlesian altruism coming from small group warfare, so it's all connected.
So, George, I was almost dreading bringing this up, but I see that you brought it up yourself in the most recent Science Times. The great debate over whether science and religion actually can be, in any sense, reconciled.
Oh, right. I mean, my basic position is that science and religion, and deciding to reconcile them, is like deciding you're going to reconcile carpentry and ornithology. or pick any other two seemingly orthogonal disciplines. But I'm glad you saw that piece. It was basically the way I billed it to the editors when I wanted to do it was a night or a letter from Mount Graham, or a night on Mount Graham, and I spent the night at the Vatican's observatory on Mount Graham in southern Arizona with a Jesuit priest and a Catholic lay astronomer who's also a professor of astronomy, as they were doing some astronomical observations.
Mm-hmm. So. And so the head of this observatory was a Jesuit.
He's a Jesuit, yes. And this guy, he's the vice director, I believe his title is, Chris Corbelly, a really great guy. And then Jose Funes is now the director. And they're headquartered at Castel Gandolfo, you know, the Pope's summer residence outside of Rome. But their main observations take place on Mount Graham at this observatory. So I drove out there last spring and hung out there for, you know, throughout a night. And even, you know, besides the fact that it was the Vatican Observatory, it was a very cool experience just watching what goes on at an observatory at night and just all of the mundanities that you have to go through first just to get the telescope up and running. And then the fact that once you do, you're sitting in a control room like at a power plant looking at computer screens and kind of jabbering numbers back and forth. So
not very romantic, huh?
Well, that was one thing that Chris Corbelly said. He said people say, oh, it must be so wonderful being an astronomer and being out there among the stars. And then he says, well, it's great if you like TV.
Yeah, really boring TV, it sounds like.
Very, very wry sense of humor. But one of my best favorite moments was just walking out on an observation deck, you know, getting out of the room with all the fluorescent lights and computer screens and these computer images of the sky, and then suddenly you go out and look straight up and see the, you know, the unfiltered, unprocessed sky. It was really kind of a neat moment. And then I was talking to one of the other astronomers while we were doing that. But these are both really great people. They were devoutly religious, and it was clear that religion drove their interest in understanding what they could about the universe. But at the same time, there was no sense that it you know, that it affected the outcome of their observations. It was like two separate things for them. I mean, not separate, one motivated the other, but there wasn't a whole lot of crosstalk or any that I could see.
Did you actually ask them about their religious beliefs at all?
A little bit, and Corbelly's been interviewed about this a lot before, and it all comes down to, I got into this a little bit with, you know, just the whole, you know, Catholic philosophy and, I mean, actually a lot of, not just Catholic theology, but the idea of the prime mover, the unmoved mover, and secondary causes. So, you know, the secondary causes are motivated originally by the prime mover in the creation of the universe, but that, you know, then you're just left to study the secondary causes. Now, of course, that doesn't, you know, people often still believe all that and still believe in miracles where the prime mover can come in occasionally and jostle things around. So,
do you think these guys
believe in miracles? I don't know. I mean, they both had a pretty, you know, pretty sophisticated view of theology, but I didn't really feel like sitting there and getting into some tedious theological discussion, and then it would just be one more of these science and religion gotcha kind of articles.
I wonder if, I mean, it seems to me that the only possible, you know, the irony is that the Big Bang Theory has turned out to be just great for Christian theology, because it does suggest that there was a creation and, you know, a creation event.
Yeah, and it was a Jesuit that was one of the the first Big Bangers, right? Lemaître?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what's his name? Arno Penzias is a devout Jew. You know, saw the... Arno Penzias was one of the scientists who discovered the microwave background that's thought to be the afterglow.
Yeah.
Of the Big Bang, which was in the early 1960s. He was using a big radio telescope.
Yeah.
And so I would think that the only possible observation that could really sort of upset this reconciliation between Christianity and cosmology, anyway, would be the discovery that maybe that Fred Hoyle was right and steady state cosmology is a more accurate representation.
Yeah, but then steady state, you know, I mean, that can, what can look like steady state from the inside out, you know, with us, you know, looking at our little secondary causes, you can still imagine stepping out of the whole universe and having somebody, you know, like a creator who's created this universe in which the illusion is from the inside that it's steady state. So there's just no end to these arguments, which is why I just kind of found it refreshing to see people just, you know, putting one thing to one side of their brain and the other to the other and then getting on with it and doing some cool science. And
yeah. Well, some people just can't do that.
I know, they feel compelled to form this reconciliation, and that's when I start, you know, heading for the exits.
Well, okay, so I wasn't sure how much I should get into this in this chat, because I'm doing something later.
Yeah, we've talked about it before, and boy, there was, did you see the chat between our friends Bob and Barb? Robert White and Barbara Bradley Haggerty, the NPR religious correspondent, who, I will mention, John and I both spent 3 weeks with Barbara and a few other people, which we've brought up this before too, in Cambridge, England, as Templeton Foundation fellows and journalism fellows in science and religion, and Barbara was there. And I remember astonished both of us on maybe the very first day when we realized that she was devoutly religious, and then when we realized that there were other people among our little group of 10 journalists who were devoutly religious. And
yeah.
I thought, oh, wow, I guess journalists can be devoutly religious. Science journalists. I mean, some of them are religion journalists. So, I mean, that was a naive reaction, but it was still a little surprising to me.
Yeah, it was surprising to me, too. I really, I like Barb so much. I've seen her at least once since then down in Washington. I've talked to her a bunch of times, and she had told me that she started talking about this book just as she was beginning to write it, and we corresponded a few times in the middle of it. She has looked at some of the same research programs that I looked at in my last book, Rational Mysticism. And
Came up in the discussion, too.
Yeah, oh, really?
The God Helmet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
The God Helmet, that's the this device created by this wacky psychologist up in Canada, Michael Persinger, who said that you can simulate religious experiences by electromagnetically tickling certain parts of the brain. And so I went up there and put this thing on, and nothing happened to me. Richard Dawkins put it on, nothing happened to him. To be honest,
I guess Barb did that too, but I'm not sure. I think she suggested that nothing happened to her either, or it was subtle at best. I can't remember what she said.
Yeah.
I haven't read the book yet. And then Bob brought up the point. I mean, even if you did have an effect, I mean, you know, it's not that, it wouldn't be so surprising or earth-shaking. It's like taking drugs. You know, you can have this, you know, what some people take as a spiritual reaction.
Right. So you have these hallucinations.
Not electromagnetic waves zapping parts of your brain.
Yeah. You have these hallucinations, and then the question is, what do you do with them? Do you decide that they're true and meaningful? I mean, people have
dreams.
Interpret
them, yeah.
People have dreams, and some of them are completely nonsensical. Some of them actually are, you know, have some sort of useful meaning embedded in them. And
I've heard voices in the wilderness.
You have?
Of course, yeah. And I interpret them as, God, it's so quiet here that my brain, probably the left side of my brain, is confabulating and saying little things. Or if I'm driving with the window open, you know, I'll start here. Sometimes I'll hear orchestral music.
Really? That's
and
so
my,
interesting.
My interpretation is that my brain's getting these white noise signals, you know, from the roar of the wind in the window, like the wind in the willow or something, and then it's just imposing the structure on it.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, if I were, you know, so disposed, I could say, oh, God is playing music to me to accompany me on my journey, and maybe it's St. Jude who's going to make sure that I arrive safely. And
well, geez, George, what happens if God actually does talk to you? You're just going to throw it out with all the other...
But, I mean, you know, I'll... Yeah. But, you know, if I saw a burning bush in the wilderness, I would, you know, you could come up with all kinds of good rational explanations for why that happened.
Well, you know,
including spontaneous vegetative combustion.
So, I liked Barb's book a lot. I thought that she did a great job of reporting on all these different research efforts where people are trying to figure out what neural processes underpin religious experiences. Mm-hmm. She looks at some of the studies of meditation and how that affects the brain and how it affects our sense of well-being. She also talks about her own personal religious experiences, and she's had some very powerful encounters with a very personal God, and, you know, really with Jesus Christ, which she describes very movingly in the book. And I remember she was talking about them when we met her over in Cambridge, and at that point she was really not sure whether she wanted to talk about these things openly, because she thought it might, it might compromise her position as a supposedly objective reporter for NPR. And I told her I think that people should be upfront about their own personal experiences and philosophies, and then let readers or viewers or listeners make up their mind as to whether you are.
They can filter as they consider it appropriate. But
right, and also in this case,
that's not really the tradition in journalism, though. It'd be like a political reporter declaring himself as a Republican, you know, if there are any of those, and a Democrat or communist.
It's usually kind of, I think there's a place for objective reporting, but in some cases, especially if you're writing a whole book, I want to know where you're coming from.
Oh, well, sure. Absolutely, for a book. I'm thinking more of day-to-day, you know, beat kind of journalism. But,
yeah.
Well, I'll have to read the book. I plan to. I just haven't received my free copy in the mail from the book publicist.
Well, I think probably
I'll buy it, Barb.
What distinguishes Barb from us, I guess, is that she really believes in a personal God, and a God who cares about her, Barb Haggerty, as an individual, whereas you and I, well, I'll speak for myself, you tell me whether you agree. I find the universe, I find this reality awfully odd, and I think it does have this kind of designed aspect to it. It's got drama, it's got narrative, and it just seems really hard to believe that it's just pure accident. But then when I try to come up with any kind of plausible motive of creation or look at the traditional concepts of God and his relationship to us, you know, loving us, for example, really caring about our personal welfare, none of those make any sense to me. Because the world just, there are elements of reality that are definitely, to my mind, just purely random, and life is really unfair and tragic in many respects. And
I'm totally fine with the being random fluke of the universe. I mean, I think I said that before, that I find that idea kind of liberating. And I mean, how can you imagine a reality that wouldn't seem, you know, eerie and significant and special to the people who are living the reality, since by definition there can be but one reality?
Right.
You know,
right.
So
we're all the stars of our own little drama. I mean, we're all, narcissism is just built into us from the very fact that our perception, that we're at the center of all our perceptions.
Well, it would have to be, yeah. I mean,
you never think that it doesn't bother you that science is completely inadequate for explaining the creation in the first place?
No, I mean, I just think it's absolutely amazing what we can explain.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that you can send a space probe, you know, and land it on a planet, or orbit around a planet or a moon of a planet, and send back signals that can be unpacked into visual images,
yeah,
and then move on to another place, and just to have that kind of control It just absolutely astonishes me, sometimes to the fact that I wonder if it's really true. Are they really doing this, or is the computer injecting all of this stuff based on people's, you know, unwitting assumptions and designing the system? I don't really believe that, but it just seems so amazing to me that that we can do these things. So the fact that we can't explain, you know, the ultimate meaning and origin of the universe, I mean, who would ever expect to be able to do that?
Well, a lot of people do expect to be able to do that.
Yeah,
a lot of scientists.
I know. But they won't, though. You can't step out of the system. We're part of the system, and there's only a limit to how much of a piece of the system can explain and transcend the entire system.
You're such a satisfied agnostic. I wish I could be. I wish I could be that satisfied. I've still got this kind of.
Well, I'm not satisfied in a smug sort of way. I mean, I still marvel at, you know, and just think, gee, God, what is this all about? And you know, and I can certainly see why, you know, people, you know, take the leap and just decide, well, you know, you can't tell me that it's not true that there's this particular kind of God, so. You know, take the leap and do it, and if it helps explain things to you, and certainly if it contributes to you cooperating with other people for good ends, and, you know, like maybe, you know, helping people build houses or, you know, feeding the poor or helping people not be poor, then, you know, that's great.
Or killing infidels.
Well, that's not great.
Yeah. Hey, I thought you were setting up when you were talking about sending out spaceships. I thought you were setting up a segue to the 40th anniversary of the first moon landing.
Oh, that's right. God. Oh, I have such vivid memories of the first moon landing, and the fact that it was 40 years ago just makes me feel terribly old.
Do you actually have one of those flashbulb memories of what you were doing when Neil Armstrong? What were you doing?
I remember.
And we're talking. By the way, we're talking about when Neil Armstrong stepped out of what was it called, the Eagle module, onto the surface of the moon. This was July 20th, 1969.
Wow. Yeah. Neil Armstrong. I guess people still know who he was.
So
69. This was the summer between my junior and senior year in high school. Mm-hmm. And some friends and I were taking an advanced history of Western civilization class or something during the summer because we'd heard that, you know, the person who was teaching it was doing it as kind of a real easy, fun, summery gut course, and then we wouldn't have to take the really hard one during senior year. It was a big mistake. It just, you know, set back my education by many years, and I'm still trying to make up for it. But my parents had gone with the rest of my family on a camping trip, I think, and left me alone in the house. And one of my friends came over, and we were working on our projects. And then I remember we realized, oh, yeah, you know, it's the moon landing. So we turned on the black and white TV, and, you know, we're seeing the moon landing, and then stepped out in the backyard and then kind of looked up at the moon. And just, I remember this feeling of like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, way out there, this guy's, you know, stepping out on the moon, you know, and that's what's on TV here. And then I remember after that walking up to an A&W root beer stand and getting a root beer. So that's my flashbulb memory. Stroboscopic memory.
So my flashbulb memory is I was up in Nantucket with my family, but we didn't have a TV in our house. We were in this little cottage in a village called Walwinnet, way out on one end of the island. And so we had a neighbor who did have a TV, so I walked over there, and there were a bunch of people jammed into this living room. I remember I was lying on the floor right in front of the TV because there was no room on chairs or couches, and just staring at that, and it was a tiny TV, really grainy image, and I think the image was especially grainy because it was, you know, it was being transmitted from the moon, and I just remember really being awestruck, even though at that time I was 16 years old, and I was going through my sullen, unimpressed teenager phase. But I was really impressed by this, and I remember, you know, so I was into sci-fi then, and I just thought, this is our manifest destiny. We're this is our, you know, just what Armstrong said, this is the first step of humanity
right.
into the great unknown of outer space. And and of course it hasn't worked out that way.
No, he decided to have the Vietnam War instead.
Yeah. And it was, you know, so that was sort of the best aspect of science and technology, going to the moon. And but then for me and a lot of people in our generation, I think science and technology became associated with warfare and nuclear weapons and industrial pollution and all those sorts of things. And
yeah, the scientist is the evil force. And then it got in, you know, kind of grew out of the whole 60s kind of mentality, and then it got ingrained in the movies too. So, you know, like you have the evil scientist coming to try to capture poor E.T.
Right. Although they remember the scientist who was the head of that group was that French director who was Truffaut?
Yeah, I know what you mean. But that's a different movie, right? That's
no, that was E.T.
Close Encounters with the Third Kind.
Oh, it was a Close Encounters.
Okay. If that's the one I'm thinking of. But yeah, there were good. There were some good scientists.
Oh, Peter Coyote, it was.
Oh, okay.
E.T. And he was actually pretty sympathetic. So he wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, they were scary at first, but he had this sort of childlike fascination with the idea of extraterrestrials too.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of space being our destiny has really kind of faded. So, you know, it looks to me, I mean, George Bush talked about putting humans on Mars. Barack Obama, I guess, has paid lip service to that goal. But at this point, I think it's highly unlikely it'll happen within any kind of conceivable time frame.
Yeah,
and I don't think it should.
First, no.
Yeah, I don't think it should happen.
No.
Which, you know, I hate to say that because I still, you know, I still love the idea of space as this great adventure.
Mm.
But, you know, it's just obscene to spend that kind of money on these things when we have so many tremendous problems here at home.
Yeah, well, certainly if it's spent at the expense of the problems, but I guess I'm not convinced that we couldn't do both if we really, really wanted to.
Yeah, I guess
yeah.
so.
Ah, oh, space, yeah.
But, you know, just going back to religion for a moment, I should mention
that.
Yeah,
here's the segue. So what does it happen, you know, the old question, if we discover an extraterrestrial civilization that's at least as advanced as ours, you know, how does this affect religious believers?
Yeah, well, TLR...
That's something that Chris Corbelly, the Jesuit astronomer, is referred to as the gotcha question that the journalists are always kind of sitting there smugly waiting to spring on him.
TLR de Chardin, I'm not sure if I mangled his name.
Yeah,
you know,
mega point.
Yeah, the great Jesuit thinker. He actually wrote, and I think this is a little subfield of theology about whether Jesus just died for our sins or whether he also died for the sins of E.T.
Yeah, right. So it's been a long mold question.
Yeah. What I was gonna mention is that I actually just finished Bob Wright's book yesterday.
Oh yeah. Do you have a copy right there?
I have a copy right here.
Yeah, I do too. Let's both hold it up at the same time so they can get a double frame. You know, just
I put
in
the
solidarity
cover up, though.
With our leader.
I'm just showing it in its naked form.
Okay.
But you can still see the spine. The evolution of God.
Yeah.
And I think it should be the evolution of Bob.
The evolution of Bob, okay.
The evolution of Bob. I read this, I was going to read it anyway, but I read it more quickly than I would have because I am supposed to be doing an online chat for something called Fire Dog Lake on Sunday, which is a book salon.
Oh,
and,
Fire Dog Lake?
FireDogLake.com.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, you'll send a link in for that
yeah.
to the central headquarters.
Yeah.
I'd like to watch that.
But, first of all, I love Bob's writing. Everything he writes, it sounds like Bob. And you think that would be an easy thing to achieve, that, you know, people have a natural voice, that they're writing sounds sort of conversational and informal. It sounds like what they the same way that they speak. But as you know, it's a really difficult trick to pull off for lots of writers. But so Bob is very sort of witty and ironic and wry in his writing, as he is in person. The book
and
is
with
also
a clarity of thought that I really envy.
Yeah, he's a really smart guy. He's also poured an enormous amount of scholarship into this book. It's really kind of a history of religion, starting with the most primitive forms of shamanism, where we basically attributed some kind of spirit to everything that happened out there in nature. So there were spirits in mountains and in trees and in rivers and storms and everything. And then that evolved, became a little more sophisticated with the Greek gods. There were all these different versions of polytheism, and then those gave rise to the first great monotheistic faith, Judaism, then Christianity, then Islam. And Bob does an amazing job of showing the kind of logical progression of these different religions, and showing that there is a kind of moral progression in them as well. So, the original shamanistic spirits could often be nasty. There really wasn't any right or wrong about it.
Yeah.
But then gradually you got the God of the Bible, who was sort of telling us how we should live our lives, and in the New Testament at least preaching love of our neighbors and even love of our enemies and these sorts of things.
Yeah. And, it's all propelled by the zero-sumness of life.
Yeah. And the thing is, Bob recognizes that what's really interesting and ironic about the book is that he basically traces the shifts of scripture and the different forms of morality that we get from different parts of the Bible or the Quran to things that were happening in the surroundings of the particular author of that part of the scripture. And he said there's often a lot of political expediency behind different moral precepts. So, to put it really crudely, you've got in the some of the first parts of the Quran that were dictated by Muhammad, he's preaching love and tolerance and brotherhood, and he's not saying that his version of faith is the only one. He's very tolerant of Christianity and Judaism, and Bob explains that as basically Muhammad being in a very weak position. And so, you know, when you're in a weak position, you're trying to get along with everybody else, and so you're sounding as nice as possible. Then when Muhammad, and this is when he was in Mecca originally, then Muhammad, you know, his message was basically falling on deaf ears, and he moved to Medina, and he started building a serious following. You know, and started gathering a military force. So and then he became a really powerful political figure. And that's when the Quran, what he's dictating for the Quran, starts becoming much more harsh and intolerant. And you get these messages that are interpreted by some modern Muslims as, you know, kill all the infidels.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, Bob is basically saying that the supposed moral truth coming from these scriptures is actually shaped by politics and circumstance and these, you know, these very human conditions.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's kind of the approach that Elaine Pagels took, you know, in the Gnostic Gospels, and you know, showing about, you know, the political struggles at the time and how these can be used to explain, you know, what books were admitted into the canon and which ones were excluded. And
right.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is, you know, you adjust the memes to not because of some higher moral truth, but to make the memes more successful.
So stepping back and looking at the book from a distance, it's basically a rationalist explanation of how religion would be expected to evolve. I mean, in the general shape of things, that it would be kind of driven by altruism and zero-sumness, but then along with these contingencies of the particular history of the time.
Yeah, but, okay, so here's the thing. At the end of the book, and he hints at this in the beginning, and then he comes right out and says it at the end. He thinks that, you know, there is this moral progress that you can sort of discern within the history of religion toward more and more tolerance and a recognition of the commonality of all people.
Yeah.
And the you know, the golden rule as a guiding principle of behavior. And Bob thinks that... that this progression, which of course is, has been very fitful, is evidence that there is a God.
Hmm. He actually says that.
Yeah.
Hmm. I haven't read the end yet.
Which I find, you know, to me, I see it as evidence that, you know, that religions, you know, so yeah, in the Old Testament, you had God commanding the Hebrews to slaughter people in the lands that they wanted to occupy. You know, it's just really brutal, harsh stuff. This is what Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins and Harris, the atheist critics of religion seize on to criticize religion as a whole. So that was really bad. But then, you know, in the New Testament, you get a philosophy of love and universal brotherhood and so forth. And And I see that just as the triumph of human common sense and decency over human delusion and hypocrisy and self-righteousness.
So where does the common sense and decency come from?
Well, you know, the golden... I don't see what the big deal is with morality. I mean, you know...
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you on that. I mean, it's hard to explain, but it's certainly... The explanation is certainly conceivable in terms of evolution, whether it's group selection and altruism or kin selection, or the fact that once a brain evolves a certain amount of computational capacity, it can almost become decoupled from the evolutionary substrate and, you know, imagine and decide and execute things that aren't, you know, just completely rooted in, you know, in the dirt.
Well, you know, you can explain the golden rule to a 5-year-old.
Yeah, so.
And really, the golden rule is a wonderful basis for really all morality.
Yeah,
and it's, you don't need that to come down to you from some, you know, commandments that are carved in stone by God. I mean, so as I said, common sense and common decency, because fortunately, natural selection has embedded some of these altruistic, empathetic capacities in us, as well as aggression and all that stuff.
I've got to finish reading this, because I would think that everything we've just been saying all seems to be consistent with what Bob's been arguing for years. But maybe I've misunderstood something.
Yeah, well, and also then it's a matter of, why do you want to preserve? So Bob, you know, Bob is saying that the major religions are wrong in many respects, and that the God he's talking about is very different from the God in most of the Bible, and it's not anthropomorphic, and you know, so he qualifies the hell out of it, but it's still God of some kind. And then he even says, you know, it's a God of love. So then it is a kind of personal God, and that's when I really start having problems with it.
Yeah.
So, but I'll try to spell that out in this dialogue that we have. On Sunday.
Yeah, I'll listen. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting that this has been motivating him for so long. I mean, the third part of Three Scientists and Their Gods, in which he's talking about, what's his name? The Quaker?
Kenneth Boulding.
Kenneth Balding, right. And he gets into Teilhard de Chardin and the you know, and the Omega Point and this, and it's sort of, you know, already edging towards this idea of zero sumness and
yeah.
So this kind of takes it to its fruition.
Well, geez, you know, I agree with Bob. I mean, you know, I've been like ranting about the end of war here for quite some time. So, yeah. You know, I've got my own utopian vision, but I guess the difference between Bob and me is that if I, you know, I do think, who knows, maybe there was a creator, but we are on our own now, completely on our own. Our morality is self-created.
Yeah.
There's no divine destiny for us. Nothing we can discern anyway, and we need to take responsibility for ourselves. So I think we need to get rid of all these ancient superstitious systems because they're just bogging us down.
Yeah, and they're not going away.
Yeah. Well, actually, they are going away in some parts of the world. I mean, agnosticism sort of a religion is increasing in the United States, and it's pervasive in Western Europe. So that
Europe, but the United States?
Yes. The last time I looked, I wrote an essay about religion and anti-religion a couple of years ago for the Times, and people who say that they are not religious. So they don't have to be just, they can be atheist or agnostic, or they can just say they're not religious. That's the fastest growing group in the United States. This was according to Gallup polls maybe 3-4 years ago.
Yeah.
There's hope. That's my, those few times when I believe in God, it's when I see evidence of the decline of religion.
Well, those are inspiring words, John. I don't know that I can top that.
We muddled through another hour. Look at that.
Yeah. God, it is an hour. Wow. 101:54-55. So, shall we do this again soon?
Make us.
Once every few weeks sounds good.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, what are you working on now?
I'm still hacking away at this war manuscript.
Oh, okay. I have another piece coming out in the Times on Tuesday, I'll mention.
Wow.
An archaeology piece. I wrote both of these, you know, like weeks and weeks and weeks ago, and then they just kind of, you know, went into the hopper and sat there, and now they're all finally emerging.
Well, I can't wait. Well, we'll have something to talk about again next time we meet.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, George.
Okay, well, good luck with that.
Thanks. Enjoy your summer.
Okay, you too.